in their words, ash and rock and magma being thrown out at the volcano.
Bogoslav puts on a lava show. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Homer Electric Co-op members say no to deregulation.
Unregulated monopolies are just generally a bad idea for the consumer.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
It's a fact. Over half of Alaska Native adults don't use tobacco. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message is sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
For the third time in as many days, Bogoslav volcano has erupted. From KUCB in Unalaska, Zoe Sobel has more.
Bogoslav volcano is on an uninhabited island 60 miles northwest of Unalaska. Michelle Coombs, a scientist with the AVO, says they were cued into today's eruption by lightning.
Worldwide Lightning Location Network pinged us and let us know that there was lightning in the area, which indicates that you might have a volcanic ash cloud.
Those suspicions were confirmed. Soon after that came a call from a nearby Coast Guard cutter, the Alex Haley.
They could see ash and ash cloud and, in their words, ash and rock and magma being thrown out at the volcano.
Coombs says these observations of steaming and magma suggest the formation of a new lava dome.
The lava domes often form at the end or after an explosive eruption, you get the kind of less gassy magma come out at the end in the form of a lava dome.
But Coombs says an equally likely possibility is that the eruption continues. Experts cannot predict how long the eruption might last because there is no monitoring equipment on Bogoslav. In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Last week, Alaska's Supreme Court issued an opinion on a Prudhoe Bay tax law case that has been open for 10 years. Alaska's Energy Desk reporter Rasha McChesney sat down with the former Department of Revenue Tax Division head, Dan Dickinson.
We're here today to talk about an elf, but not the kind of elf you typically hear about this time of year. This elf is called an economic limit factor, and it was a key part of the way the state calculated production tax rates in the Prudhoe Bay oil field from the 1970s to the mid-2000s. And the Department of Revenue's interpretation of that ELF led to the Prudhoe Bay producers lawsuit that went all the way up to the Supreme Court.
So it was a procedural question of how we came to that conclusion and how we adopted it.
And so the foundation of this lawsuit was that the Department of Revenue had two different tax rates in Prudhoe Bay. You had these big fields that were taxed at one rate, and then these smaller satellite fields that were still technically in Prudhoe Bay, but they were taxed at another rate because, in theory, those fields required the same kind of infrastructure to operate, but had fewer economies of scale. So the state taxed them at a lower rate to keep them profitable?
What the state did is it created a formula, a very complex formula. And what the effect of that formula was is it made the taxes on very large fields higher and the taxes on smaller fields very much lower. Size became very important.
So the state formula ended up kind of incentivizing the development of these smaller satellite fields that were taxed at a lower rate. Do you remember the difference in the tax rate? I'm recalling something like 15% on the larger fields and 0.5% on the smaller fields.
That's on average. But yes, the smaller fields could very easily be driven to zero, and some of them were slightly above zero.
So producers and field operators started prioritizing oil that came from these satellite fields over oil that came from the big ones. But it wasn't just so that they could pay that lower rate. It was also because newer wells tended to produce more oil and less of the gas and water and sand that comes out of older wells. But no matter which field the oil was coming from, old or new, the producers were the same. Companies were developing new satellite fields and asking for them to be taxed separately from the older, larger fields. What were the discussions at the Department of Revenue at the time?
The focus on the tax has always been, there's a tension between two aspects of it. One of it is the state obviously wants to get the money from the tax. On the other hand, they clearly recognize that a poor tax regime will inhibit the kind of growth and the investment that it wants.
So at some point, the Department of Revenue decides to change the way it's interpreting the tax law and informs the companies that it's going to combine most of those smaller satellite fields into larger fields for calculating production taxes.
The effect of that would have been the tax on Prudhoe Bay would have, on the main field, would have gone down just a hair, but the tax on all the other remaining fields would have gone up considerably. It would have increased taxes by more than $100 million a year. I know that.
So the Department of Revenue issues this decision, and it's estimated to increase taxes by $100 million a year. But then the next year, the legislature decides to toss out the ELF system and put something else in place, and then it decides to do it retroactively. So there's like a 4 or 5 month period where they were taxed under one system, and then it switches to a new system. So all told, this new interpretation of the ELF was in place for about a year, year and a half?
Yes.
So the oil companies pay that $100 million in production taxes, and then they sue, and all told, it's taken a decade for them to exhaust their legal remedies. Now, the state isn't on the hook for paying the money back, so what's your takeaway from this whole process and the final resolution of the lawsuit?
It would be nice if the statutes were nice and clear. The legislature set out exactly what they wanted and set it in such a way that it made sense when you had to actually deal with a tax. That's just not what happens in the real world. People sitting in Juneau come up with sort of a very conceptual idea, and applying it to actual returns and companies is a difficult task. I think it generally gives a clear line as to when the department can act and when it can't.
The Supreme Court issued its final ruling on December 16th. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Homer Electric Association members voted overwhelmingly against deregulation, and the cooperative will remain under the oversight of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. About 70% of voters said they wanted the RCA, the agency which oversees public utilities in Alaska, to continue the practice. KBBI's Dasha Eaton has more.
ATA officials made the announcement Tuesday. ATA ratepayer and outspoken critic of deregulation, Mike O'Meara, says members sent a clear message to ATA's management through the vote.
They don't trust the management to conduct business in the appropriate way without oversight from the RCA. And unregulated monopolies are just generally a bad idea for the consumer.
The cooperative is the sole provider of electricity to nearly 23,000 members on the Kenai Peninsula. Almost a third of membership voted. ATA's 9-member board of directors voted unanimously in April to hold the deregulation election. This October, members received ballots with their electric bills. O'Meara says ATA's management and board need to do more outreach to members. He suggests informal listening sessions. O'Meara says the vote shows ATA's management and board are not on the same page as the people they serve.
They were totally out of touch with what the wider membership felt.
Bruce Shelley, director of member relations for ATA, says the relatively large voter turnout highlights one of the values of the cooperative model, enabling members to provide direction to their utility.
ATA is very, very pleased by the voter turnout on such an important decision.
Under Alaska statute, the cooperative won't be able to hold another deregulation election for 2 years. In Homer, I'm Dasha Eaton.
A Copper Center woman was killed on the Glen Highway. Alaska State Troopers report that 54-year-old Susan Voiles was reportedly hit by a vehicle after 2 a.m. this morning. Troopers say the vehicle's driver, 24-year-old Andre Ionashku, told them he saw another vehicle stopped on the opposite side of the highway with headlights on near mile 178, and a woman walked into his path of travel. Ionashku said he could not stop in time and hit the woman. Voiles died as a result of the collision. Troopers say they learned shortly before the incident that Voiles had called trooper dispatch to report she'd lost a box from her vehicle and was going to attempt to find it. They say the state medical examiner will conduct an autopsy. Drugs and alcohol do not appear to be factors in the incident. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, bringing joy to a child through simple holiday lights.
They come up and he lets her run around in the yard. I can sit in my living room and I can hear her laugh.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Santa is going to be a little late to a few villages this year, KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Freezing fog in Bethel this week and the week before prevented the Army National Guard from flying their UH-60 Blackhawk to Akiak, Tuluksak, and Grayling to deliver food and toys for Alaska's 60th Operation Santa Claus. Since 1956, the tradition has brought together the Alaska National Guard, local businesses, and community groups to collect and deliver gifts to a few villages each Christmas. April Geddes organizes the event for the Guard.
We asked the schools when we got weathered out this time, we said, would you like to distribute everything before Christmas, or would you like us to reschedule, knowing that we could not make it until the 4th, 5th, or 6th? So the villages all agreed they'd rather have us come out with Santa Claus and some of the military members and give the kids the attention that we were able to give to all of the other villages.
The trip is rescheduled for the first week of January after school gets back in session.
It's post-Christmas, but it is pre-Russian Orthodox.
Slavic is January 7th. The holiday is celebrated in Akiak and Tuluksak, but not Grayling. Logistics mean that gifts to all three villages have to be delivered the same day.
And what do the gifts consist of? What would a kid get?
Well, it depends on what Santa's elves make. It could be anything from models and Legos to basketballs, soccer balls, paint supplies, art supplies.
Every child age 0 to 18 receives a gift. School-age kids receive a backpack of school supplies and a personal hygiene bag,
which consists of toothbrush, toothpaste, soap, shampoo, conditioner.
And it doesn't stop there. The operation also brings out fresh fruit, bananas, apples, and oranges, and 1 ton of food that's non-perishable for the village.
It's flour, sugar, rice, powdered milk, cereal, canned vegetables, pasta, soups. We've reached out to the villages and asked them what they could utilize most, and that was the list that they gave us.
If weather doesn't cooperate in January, the village schools will distribute the food and presents. In fact, they're already sitting there, waiting for Santa to hand them out. Operation Santa Claus made deliveries to Akiachuk and Togiak already earlier this season. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Diesel is running about $2.71 per gallon in Southeast Alaska, but in places that depend on diesel for electricity, there are still households that won't let the cost dampen the holiday spirit. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
For Nancy Bean, a Cake resident, it started off small, with a couple of light-up reindeer. But every year, she's added something new.
We have lights everywhere. You know, some houses just have a little bit, and some houses have a lot, and I have more than a lot.
A decorative train, two angels with trumpets, a waving Santa, strings and strings of multicolored lights, and more.
One thing we bought, and I don't think I'll do this again, is we bought a 10-foot Christmas tree, a blow-up, and it is beautiful when the wind's not blowing.
Cake is a small community of about 600 people, and Bean estimates there's nearly 20 homes decked out for the holidays. What's powering those festive displays is diesel, which can be expensive. Bean qualifies for Power Cost Equalization, a state-funded program that helps lower electric rates in remote places. Still, she says on average, the lights add up to an extra $200 on her electric bill. North of Cake in Angoon, Frank Willis says his is only one of three or four houses decorated for the holidays, and his display was hard-fought.
The first one we put up, the dogs chewed through it.
Angoon is another village with less than 500 people. And like Cake, it also runs off diesel.
Putting up Christmas lights used to be a big thing around here, and it's just kind of like going downhill the past few years. And I don't know, just kind of hoping to get everybody back into the spirit.
Nancy Bean says that's what motivates her. When pressed, she's modest about having a house that looks like a snow globe, one of the most decorated in Cake. She says both adults and children stop to admire the twinkling lights, the waving Santa. There's this one girl, she says.
Her mother passed away, and she's staying with her uncle. And he brings her up every single night. They come up, and he lets her run around in the yard. I can sit in my living room, and I can hear her laugh. And that's what it's all about.
I ask Bean if she'll buy more holiday displays next year, and she answers yes without hesitation. She says it's not just the decorations that light up, it's the faces of the people, too. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
For over a decade, there was no place to check out a book in Cake, Alaska. Tucked into a pocket on Kuprianoff Island, the Cake School District closed the library in 1999 due to funding loss. But through partnerships and volunteers, books were put back on the shelves and the library reopened. KCAW's Emily Kwong has this report.
Ooh, Heroes at the Frontier. Dave Eggers.
Yeah, look, these are really great.
Christmas has come early for Jocelyn McKinnon Crowley. She's unpacking a cardboard box filled to the brim with hardcovers donated by a couple in Juneau. On top is a note.
It says, best wishes on the reopening of your library. And it's on sunflower paper.
Anything to spruce up the space is exciting for her. In the Shirley Jackson Community Library, named after a famed local teacher, there are beanbags, potted plants, and six computers at orderly attention beneath a sign that says, light up your imagination and read. The only thing out of date are the books. A good portion of the collection is pre-1999, when the library closed. And there are a lot of duplicates and classroom sets, like 20 copies of C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
We also recently removed about 1,500 books that were all pre-1960 kids books that were falling apart.
So McKinnon Crowley, a volunteer with AmeriCorps Vista, began seeking donations of gently used books, especially those geared toward kids and about Alaska. This is the seventh box to arrive. She unpacks it with relish, not bothering to shush the visiting student athletes in the corner. With new books coming in, what happens to the old books? I'm in the car of the high school's English teacher, Jory Grant. She and McKinnon Crowley, the Vista volunteer, are roommates. We turned down one of Cake's old logging roads. Our destination is the town dump.
What do we do about all of these extra books that are in such bad condition? Or, you know, books that are like the current Soviet Union, and you're just like, well, that's a little out of date.
To keep the black bears away, Grant cranks Billy Joel music. Barging trash off the island is too expensive, so effectively every book that comes into Cake has to stay or be set on fire in the town dump. Grant says this has been a bit of a sore spot as the library tosses outdated books, a process known as weeding.
We put books out here before the box broke open and people were like, they're throwing away the books! But we were like, guys, these are really bad old books. We can't afford to send them to other places. So like, what else are we gonna do with them? But it's still just so ingrained, like don't burn books, that everyone was like very against it.
We pile back in the car. For the record, tonight they're just taking out their apartment trash. But the problem they're talking about is a big one. I understand where those critics are coming from. It's not easy to watch even old books burn. But McKinnon Crowley reminds me that libraries aren't archives. They have to change with the times. Right now, the library sees about 40 visitors per week. And the best way to get that number up is by giving readers the books they're looking for. Reporting in Cake, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, sourdough. If you've ever flown home for the holidays, you know it's no easy feat, with everything from weather delays to wailing infants. But what's it like to travel with a companion that's more than 100 years old and could explode at any moment? KCAW's Emily Russell flew home for the holidays with a living, breathing, centuries-old jar of sourdough starter and has this story.
Okay, so I am here at the airport in Sitka, Alaska. I've got my bag checked in. I'm heading home to Massachusetts for the holidays, but I've got a bit of a journey ahead of me today. I first have an hour-long flight to Ketchikan, and then a couple-hour flight to Seattle, and then a five-hour red-eye to Logan International Airport in Boston. And, of course, before all that, I have to get through security.
Hello.
I take off my shoes, take out my laptop, and slide everything up to the mouth of the x-ray machine. My nerves get the best of me, and I blurt out about one belonging in particular.
I'm traveling with sourdough starter.
Oh.
The 3.4 ounces or less of it.
Just pull it out.
Okay.
You can have it. Just pull it out.
All right.
15 long seconds later, the bin emerges on the other side.
All right. Well, we made it through unscathed. The only thing that actually got a second look was my recording equipment. So sourdough is all safe and sound and back with me, and I feel good.
Okay, so security didn't seize my sourdough starter. But that x-ray machine, that's small potatoes compared to the challenge of actually keeping this thing alive for the next 12 hours. See, without food or oxygen, this thing could die. During Alaska's gold rush, miners would go months or even a year without a resupply of food. So to get your bread or biscuits to rise, you had to keep your starter alive year-round.
The business of sourdough is very serious.
That's Louise Brady.
My Tlingit name is Yayitau Dishgain. That's one of three. And I am Kiksedi from Sitka and grandchild of the Kalgwantan clan.
The starter Louise Brady grew up around was alive long before she was even born. It was passed down through her family, ultimately ending up with her mother, Isabella Brady.
She was definitely the queen of sourdough.
She would make sourdough pancakes every Saturday, Brady says, until she was in her 80s. Sometimes 30 or 40 people would show up.
Her sourdough pancakes were really light and very sweet and just, you know, the perfect combination of flour and the sugar, and came out beautifully browned and just amazing.
Isabella Brady passed away a few years ago, but the tradition, getting together over sourdough, it still lives on in some Sitka homes. Before leaving town for the holidays, I stopped by a friend's house for sourdough waffles, which are dished up every Sunday. Even the conversation centers around the stuff.
I think in Fairbanks it all came from the Chilkoot Trail, but here it all came from the Chichagof Mall.
That's Liz Will. She's not exactly a sourdough queen. She won't even confess to being an expert, but she does know a thing or two about traveling with starter.
My daughter's taken some of our family sourdough down to Antarctica and field camp and up north in field camps.
So before I packed up for my own trip home, I asked Will for some advice.
Just keep feeding it and try talking to it, maybe. Grow, please.
I didn't exactly talk to it, but I did check on it every few hours. At the end of the trip, it looked about as deflated as every other passenger on my red eye into Boston.
It's been a pleasure having aboard this morning.
But like most, after a long day of travel, all it takes is a few days of rest and some good food to feel yourself again. In the comfort of my mom's warm kitchen, the final test of the trip is here. I mix the sourdough starter with flour, water, and a bit of salt. I pop it in the oven for about 40 minutes until the smell of fresh bread fills the house.
What kind of jam do you want?
I think I'll try the beach plum.
Okay.
I slice two pieces and hand one to my mom.
That's very good. It's good bread. Do you want to have more?
More bread? Do you want some more?
Yeah.
That request for seconds, for me, that says it all. For AK, I'm Emily Russell.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Santa Claus. On occasion, he can be seen at Anchorage's Bass Pro Shop, listening to children's wish lists during the holiday season.
I was a bush pilot in Alaska for 40 years. I've got 18,000 hours of flying around here. It's a job that depends upon your skill, not so much as somebody else. Some of the only places I ever had to talk on the radio to land was in Anchorage. If you get out of town, there's no tower, there's no weather reporting. Most weather stations are a couple hundred miles apart. I tell kids now all I get to fly is the reindeer. Well, I tell people I grew into the position. It's just something I one day decided I wanted to do. The beard's real, and the kids test it. They grab hold and pull. What makes me the happiest is the kids that run right up to me and go, Santa. There's one young lady who's been seeing me every year for years, and every year she asks for nothing for herself. Every year she asks for good things for people. Food for the people who are hungry, and help with doctors for the people who are sick. And she never asked for a single thing for herself. Oh, it brings a tear to my eye. I'm sorry, it does. And I'm pretty hardcore. So. There's more that are hanging out in Fairbanks, but I don't know that they're all as well traveled as this Santa. Like I said, that was a road less traveled, but it was sure a lot of fun.
Santa Claus lives in the North Pole. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Russell and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Rasha McChesney and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Daisha Eaton in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Emily Kwong in Cake. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great holiday weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.